From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
My message for the people in office is, you're either with us or against us. We are losing our lives while the adults are playing around.
Let's ask ourselves, do we really think that, and I say this sincerely, do we really think 17-year-olds on their own are going to plan a nationwide rally?
There should be no doubt that Russia perceived that its past efforts as successful and views the 2018 U.S. midterm elections as a potential target for Russian influence operations.
Everybody's trying to affect the outcome of elections, Chris, and everybody's poisoning the internet. Everybody's doing it, both parties, insane, lunatic individuals. The Russians are pikers, actually, compared to Americans doing this.
This is a lawyer from a prominent New York City law firm who does have ties to both Paul Manafort as well as Rick Gates, charged now with lying to the special counsel's office and also not turning over certain documents.
And this is The Wheelhouse. You just heard John Dankosky's voice, but it was actually pre-taped. He is not here today. He is, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this or not. You may have seen over the weekend there was an incident where a Transavia airliner was forced to land early because of flatulence by a passenger who refused to stop flatulating. And John will be actually anchoring a PBS Frontline special on the problem of airline flatulence. Pretty undocumented, but it's big. I don't really get how you just, like, tell somebody they have to stop. I mean, is it completely under their control? Anyway, that's not what we'll be talking about today with our terrific panel on The Wheelhouse, joining us from NBC Connecticut, where he's a political reporter and now chairman of the Connecticut chapter of Survivors of Onion Splinters, Mr. Max Reese.
I will carry on.
Yeah. You actually got a splinter from an onion?
I did. It was a red onion. The little pieces on the top.
Did it make you feel soft somehow?
It hurt more than I should admit. It hurt a lot more than I should admit.
But then it turns out, actually, this is a thing.
There's a community of us. We're survivors.
All right. So anyway, if you've gotten a splinter from an onion and you feel like you need some sense of communion, please contact Max. Do not contact this show or this radio station. Susan Bigelow is here with us, a contributor for CT News Junkie. Kevin Rennie, lawyer, Hartford Courant columnist, blogs at dailyructions.com. You know, Kevin, I do feel as though Kevin and I sort of at least nominally appear in the Hartford Current together. Our columns.
Well, not nominally. We do appear in the Hartford Current.
I was going to say, well, I mean, like, it's nominally like you're from the right and I'm from the left or something. But I feel like we're watching this little thing where, like, Jeff Jacobs and Danny Haar got hired away, presumably for more money, by Hearst Newspapers from the Current. And then the Current hired Neil Vigdor back from Hearst Newspapers, because if you take something I love, I'll take something you love. So where's our money in this? Like, we need to, you know, I think we're a package. I'm not going anywhere without you.
We need a work action.
Yeah, $100 and 4 clean towels a week. That's what it's going to take to get us. But please bid for our services. All right, so we're going to talk.
That'll get me for 2 weeks. I only need that for 2 weeks.
All right, we need to talk to our agent about this. Don't negotiate on the air. That's a big mistake. All right, so we're going to talk initially, as you might have guessed listening to the montage as we went in, the gun conversation, which started as what you almost hate to call, well, another school shooting down in Florida. However, that was exactly a week ago today. These kinds of stories have now, used to have, a fairly predictable cycle, a sad and predictable cycle, a kind of kabuki where certain things got said by various people, and then the whole thing went away. I mean, there was a shooting in Kentucky not too long ago, a school shooting. I doubt you remember very much about this. Something different happened this time. We're still talking about it a week later. I mean, the some things are a little bit obvious, but maybe worth talking about before we talk about where this is going to spill into. So Max, one of this is you have, what, some very media-savvy young people who have decided that this is a story that won't go away.
You have all these kids who are remarkably well-spoken, incredibly articulate, and they've made it a point to be visible. They made it a point to be heard in ways we've never seen before. I was talking about this with somebody yesterday. If Columbine was kind of the original of the mass media shootings that have been covered in a wide scale, we've now kind of evolved to this most recent school shooting in Parkland, where you have the students taking a very active activist role that we've never seen before. Perhaps it's their social media savvy. Perhaps it's a generation generational thing. But these kids have become the faces of this in ways the adults have never been, really, in an activist role where they're being taken this seriously.
You know, Susan, I was talking to my students about it who are just maybe 3 or 4 years older at most than these kids. One thing that they suggested was that there may have been kind of a quiet learning curve going, too. This generation now is starting to be called the school shooting generation. They're a generation that grew up with practiced lockdowns and stuff like that. But, I mean, one question I'm beginning to have is maybe what they've also been doing is watching that very stylized and compacted kabuki that goes up around school shootings, and they just thought, well, we could probably break this cycle somehow.
No, I agree. And yeah, they have grown up with this hanging over their heads ever since they were born. They were born after Columbine, so the threat of it was always there for them. They've always had those drills. They may have guards in their schools. They're also a very protected generation in a lot of ways, where they don't have as much freedom to roam and wander as much as we did when we were kids, that sort of thing. But they do seem like they've had enough. That now that they are coming of age, they've had enough of this stuff, and they have the savvy, they have the technical tools to actually push back. And it's refreshing. It's great to see. I do worry that everyone's going to step back and sort of let them do it, but we all need to be there with them. We all need to actually support them as much as we can and use their example to keep pushing for gun control.
Well, yeah. Kevin, one of the things that they've done is render – I mean, I don't think anybody really cares in this particular instance what Rachel Maddow or Anderson Cooper or Fox and Friends have to say about this. They've kind of managed to bypass the commentariat a little bit.
Well, also, we know what they all have to say about it.
Well, there's that too. But I feel like one of their teachers, oddly enough, might be Donald Trump. Donald Trump basically has taught the world that you don't necessarily have to go through the media. You can create your own media.
I think that's true. I think also – That high school is enormous. Mm-hmm. So you have a more of a critical mass of students. I think that may make some difference. And I do think that South Florida is a more media intense place than a lot of these, you know, than a high school in Kentucky, for instance. And so the media is there, they're staying there, and they can continue to get attention. In addition to that, the story keeps unfolding, particularly in terms of what was missed. And that here's another instance where what else did you need to know to figure out that this guy was dangerous?
Right. So there's sort of a rule, an unspoken rule about media coverage, which is that every day something has to happen. And if things stop happening, then the media coverage goes away. And as Kevin is saying, well, some of that is happening not by any forethought, but because just stuff is coming out about signs that were missed. But also, I think these young people know that too, that you've got to keep creating pieces of the cycle.
Look, at the end of the day, the cable news cycle, the television news cycle it's this beast that you have to keep feeding. If you don't feed it, it's not going to work. And these kids know that. I will say, to have their own rally go viral on Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat and YouTube is almost a transcendent moment for victims after a shooting. We've never seen that. To a point that Susan made earlier about what this generation is, one of NPR's congressional correspondents tweeted about it last night, and she said, I wish I remember who precisely it was, but she said, "This generation of kids is a different generation than we've ever seen. They were born after 9/11, they've been at war their entire lives, and mass shootings, not just school shootings, whether it's Orlando or Aurora, Colorado or Sandy Hook, they have become truly normal events for these kids. And maybe they are saying, we're done with this, and we're the generation at this time right now that's going to deal with it. And we probably don't even know what the rest of the iceberg looks like. We're only at the tip of it, what the rest of these kids look like, not just in Florida, but in Colorado, New York, Connecticut, anywhere else.
I mean, I've been wondering now, Susan, whether this is a paradigm shift, not just around school shootings, but maybe about a whole bunch of topics where people's activists can take a look at these kids and say, you know what, you don't really have to sort of settle into the usual way things roll out. You might be able to take the reins a little bit more.
Right. And as to what Max was saying, well, part of growing up, part of every generation's story is pushing back against the norms that you've grown up with. And that's what these kids are doing, and they're pushing back against a lot of the really toxic norms that we've just kind of accepted over the past 20 years. Ever since 9/11, as things have tightened, as things have become more difficult and more toxic, I think that they're pushing back against it, partly because it's part of their growing up, but partly because of their unique situation. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot in this generation that's very inspiring, and I hope that there is some sort of a paradigm shift, especially as they become voting age.
The other possibility, of course, is, Kevin, is nothing changes, right? Well, this whole thing rolls out, and then it has a slightly longer lifespan, but that doesn't matter.
Wait till you see the pushback with the people who like their guns. And then there's a reason there are 300 million guns in America. And when an issue like this does have its moment again in center stage as it is now, for people, in legislators, for instance, it is astounding who likes their guns. And you find out, and it's always a surprise.
Well, I want to sort of talk a little bit about that, too. So this is one of the areas of life where the polling would suggest that something should happen that doesn't happen. So you look at the polling, and it's often like, in the 90s, about people wanting it depends on how the question is asked, right? If the question is asked in a way that seems to question the fundamental value of the Second Amendment, then the numbers change, get closer to 50-50. But if it's, do you want more background checks or something like that, you have to get up around 90. But it won't move. It won't move congressional action. And Max, we watched the heartbreaking spectacle of Sandy Hook parents walking through the halls of Congress, just trying even to buttonhole some members of Congress to see if they could get some common sense legislation passed, and it was sort of, no, I'm sorry, I feel your pain, but no. And you wonder about that. Like, why doesn't it move? Why doesn't it change? And will it change as a result of this new wave?
I think Kevin raised a good point. Who are the people that really appreciate their right to own a gun? I don't think it is as simple as right and left so much of the time, especially here in Connecticut. And when you think about Congress, yes, the gun lobby is a very powerful lobby. I don't think that that's really up for debate. But the NRA only represents, 5% of gun owners? Isn't it something like that?
It's small.
It's a very small percentage, which almost makes you wonder if you needed a moment like Parkland, right? If you needed something like this to maybe rally those other forces. I'm kind of speculating here. I don't know what it looks like, but these parents are going to be back in – there's a roundtable today with Parkland parents, I believe Sandy Hook parents at the White House. And
a listening session.
Right. Not to be confused with the roundtable. And is that really going to do anything? I'll be over here. I don't think it's going to make that much of a –
I like the idea that it's a listening session because, President Trump is in his 70s. It's never too late to try something new.
Goodness.
He's going to try listening. So, Susan, here in Connecticut, this thing has already kind of popped its head up in a way that I initially found surprising. Prasad Srinivasan, one of the many, many, many candidates for governor, both a physician and a state legislator, said that if the package of post-Sandy Hook gun laws were to be proposed anew, even though he voted for them the first time around, this time, knowing what he knows now, he wouldn't vote for them. And he said it kind of, on the weekend after Parkland, which initially I thought, well, there's something a little tin-eared about that.
Is it, though? I wonder. To the public at large, absolutely. But think of who his audience was. He was making this statement to the Connecticut Citizens Defense League. They are a very rabidly pro-gun organization. And he thinks that there's some kind of political gain to be had here. Otherwise, he wouldn't be making this statement. By embracing these people, this gun culture. There's actually a really good story, a piece in Politico a couple days ago about how it's not necessarily the NRA, it's not necessarily just the lobbyists, but it's a culture. And it's a specific kind of culture that is very insular and very paranoid and very conspiracy theory minded that is never going to change. And that particular culture is very, very powerful as well because of its connections with a lot of the other cultures that make up kind of red America, right-wing America. So he wouldn't be doing this. Representative Srinivasan would not be doing this unless he thought that there is some kind of gain he could have from it. So is that going to help him in the primary? Maybe. It's a fight to be heard right now. If you're a Republican trying to run for governor, you're just one of 50 billion people trying to run for governor. But if you can stand out in this way and get some of these activists, these very rabidly pro-gun activists on your side, well, maybe that helps.
Well, what are you going to say?
I was just going to say, we need to recognize he is nobody. He is nobody. He's going nowhere. His campaign is terrible.
I mean,
and he's raised a lot of money, though.
Well, he's raised $250,000. Yes, he's
getting qualifying contributions.
He's getting. Yeah. He's not going to come. He's not going to get 15% at the convention. He's going to try to have to petition himself onto the ballot. That's going to be a disaster. He's going to have. He barely got the endorsement of the Glastonbury Republican Town Committee. You think this is going to help him in Glastonbury?
Well,
no.
Not at all. But Max, hang on to that thought. I just do want to say. Kevin is incorrect. He is not nobody. The Hartford Current editorial page, for which Kevin and I both work until someone else meets our very reasonable prices.
Four towels.
They have described in a new editorial, Prasad Srinivasan as, quote, a crystal clear example of the corrupting influence of the gun lobby on the spineless, a shameless repudiation of one's professed principles for political game. Mr. Srinivasan has shown his true colors as an opportunist who cares more for political advancement than for the citizens and the children of the state of Connecticut.
So, you know what? I'm sorry.
No, bow me, Kevin Bauman.
Where was that language when Governor Malloy gave $30 million to Bass Pro Shops to sell guns in Bridgeport? Where was the editorial that condemned that? You want to know someone? You want to know what someone really thinks? See what they do with the money. He gave a retail enterprise that sells AR-15s at outlets in other states.
It's not the only thing.
$30 million.
Max Fries, you have the floor.
I spoke yesterday with one Republican who's very well placed with just about every candidate, and they said to me when it came to Prasad's comments, Representative Srinivasan, he said, "What on earth was he really thinking with this?" Saying number one, to your point, Kevin, he said, "Look, of all the, you can't rule anybody out after the Trump effect, right? Everyone was saying Donald Trump wasn't going to be president. Now he's president. So you don't know who's going to be governor." But he was saying if there's anybody who had a true long shot, it was Prasad Srinivasan. He reads these tea leaves in this completely confusing way. Nobody is even discussing rolling back the Sandy Hook gun reforms. No one is even kind of talking about this. And he says this. And to your point, Kevin, how on earth can you go to most Republican town committees where there are a lot of delegates specifically and say, yes, I'm your person and I'm going to get your votes? It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, this allows us to do kind of a quick shift, Susan, to the fact that tonight in West Haven, where J.R. Romano is, of course, adopting all of the strategies of his obvious mentor, Vince McMahon, there will be yet another Republican candidate's debate. I mean, the news so far has been probably more about the fact that because they are not officially declared candidates, they're exploratory candidates, Aaron Stewart, the mayor of New Britain, and legislator Tony Boucher are not invited. So you're going to have eight dudes. So should we start there? Is JR handling this the right way?
Of course not. Well, here's
not just because it's JR.
But, yeah. No.
That was a quick course, not.
No, JR. No.
You want to think about it?
No. Well, here's the thing. This is all about the rules that were. This is kind of about the rules that were set up ahead of time. That this was supposed to be only for declared candidates who raised a certain amount of money. Okay, but really, if you're holding a debate, you can invite whoever you want to invite. And at this point, if they had decided yesterday to say, "Okay, we'll have them come after all," that would have actually been kind of nice. But now, yes, tonight on the stage, there's just going to be eight guys, two women being excluded. It just confirms a whole bunch of stereotypes. It does seem like whenever cornered, J.R. Romano and a lot of sort of Republicans, especially in Washington, tend to really just double down and just stick to their guns because they think that that's what they should do. In this case, it's just kind of silly.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You could, on the one hand, Kevin, say rules are rules. On the other hand, a lot of the other candidates have said, "Oh no. Let the ladies come in."
It's almost March.
Is that how they've said it?
Let the ladies come in. They can't see my hand gestures. I'm doing kind of an almost kind of papal hand gesture. Let the ladies come in.
It's almost March. Tony Boucher has been exploring again. She did this 4 years ago. I think for almost a year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The convention's in early May. Aaron Stewart got into the race exploring it last. If you don't know that you want to be governor, what you would do as governor by now for the November election, then you're not really committed to this. And the other part of it is that the rules that the state funding mechanism applies means that you can't really be a full participant in these debates if you're an exploring candidate, because
right.
you have to be so careful about what you say.
Right. So you're actually saying maybe it just makes sense. I mean, either you go big or go or go home.
I'm saying in the middle, almost the end of February, you're either a candidate or you're not. And Susan Bicewicz has explored all sorts of candidacies, offices in the last year, and she's still exploring. Luke Bronin is still exploring. It's right. almost March.
I think there are some people who just like William Tong also really likes exploring. Like, I mean, he's sort of interested in any kind of candidacy.
Well, that's part of the silliness of covering these candidates all the time. They go, oh, well, I'm only exploring.
Right.
I'm only exploring. And you go, okay, you kind of roll your eyes and go, okay, fine, I get it, you're raising money, but let's be real here, which I guess is maybe a question for the State Elections Enforcement Commission, really. But Colin, you made fun of me over email that I was giving J.R. Romano too much credit with the way he's managed to keep the Republican see what I did there?
Explain your theory.
No, it's that – look, it's interesting. When you look at the success of the Republicans in the General Assembly, that has not translated to fundraising. It has not translated to the central party level. It just hasn't. They get excited over a $500 donation once a month. They really do. And J.R. Romano has successfully kept the Republican major events in the limelight. The 2016 convention, when they had a serious but poorly organized candidate in Dan Carter running against Chris Murphy, he successfully kept that an interest. He successfully made that an interesting convention by banning the now Hartford Current former free agent traded with a player to be named later from Connecticut Hearst Media, Neil Vigder. He was banning Neil Vigder, and that became a giant story. And a bunch of media came there. Is Neil Vigder going to show up? Now he's kept this going with this series of debates, a la the Republican presidential primary, mm-hmm. with whittling down the field. He laid out the rules a long time ago. These were not unknown rules. Aaron Stewart only announced about 3 weeks ago now, I think, officially.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and
she's exploring.
And she's exploring.
And I believe the day after she announced she was exploring, she said she might be open to the second spot on that.
But your theory is that J.R. Romano is crazy like a fox. He's not just an obnoxious punk. He's a guy who actually
what I'm saying is, at a kind of Vince McMahon level, how to keep people interested.
What's
really the job of a party chairman, right? Mm-hmm. It's to stay relevant. It's to stay in the news. It's to keep the things you want talked about. And I think J.R. Romano's done that. For Exhibit A, we're talking about the third gubernatorial Republican debate right now. And look, they're getting the press and people are going to be talking about this thing.
I guess. Although, Susan, I mean, you know, we kept the Hartford Civic Center in the news by having the roof fall in, too. So, I mean, it's kind of like, you can be in the news in a wrong way. There really is such a thing as bad publicity. And I'm wondering, since 50% of the human population are women, you know, whether this is really – I mean, if that's his strategy, I'm wondering if it's a good one.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like he's done this on purpose because this is just such a bad
– right on that.
Yeah, I mean, he's done it, absolutely, but I think he kind of wandered into it. I don't think he did this on purpose. I think it's such a bad look, especially now, especially after the Me Too movement, especially after high-profile women are starting to run for office and win. It's silly. And at this point, she should know better.
All right. We're going to take a little break here. I want to come back. I want to spend a little bit more time on the Republican candidate field.
Oh, we have to come back.
All yeah. Right. I'm the producers. I'm famous for screwing up the clock here. So, and I've already done it. So we'll come back. Hold your thoughts about the Republican candidate field. These are important thoughts. All right, so we are back. This is The Wheelhouse. It's slightly out of control because John's not here. I'm Colin. Susan Bigelow is here, contributor to CT News Junkie, Kevin Rennie, lawyer and Hartford Current columnist, blogs at dailyructions.com, and Max Rees. Every 5 minutes in America, someone gets a splinter from an onion. If that's happened to you, contact Max. He's running a survivor's chapter. He's also a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. And a dad. And your baby slept 11 hours last night?
My daughter slept 11 hours last night.
Wow.
She's the favorite in the house currently.
Yeah. And that's
how much paragoric did you have to put on her gums?
I'm not going to go into the details, but our son woke up at 3 a.m. and every 20 minutes after that.
All right, so it doesn't really matter. Okay, so we're going to stay with the political questions for a little longer, too, because just we haven't really talked about the Republican field that much on the wheelhouse so far. So there's a couple of other things that are going on here. One of them is, Kevin, there are some very well-heeled candidates who are part of this complicated mix of the Republican field. They often come out of what we could just call the kind of financial sector, so we don't have to split hairs about
private economy.
Private economy, whatever you want to call it. But they're, you know, some of them are hedge fund people, some of them are traders, some of them are VC people. I don't really know exactly what everybody is. But some of them seem to like not want to go to the debates. I'm thinking of David Stemmerman and Robert Stefanowski. They don't want to go to the town committee meetings that much. And they might not even care too much about the convention where they'd have to get 15% to come out and automatically be on the ballot. So what is their plan? What are these guys
going to
do?
Well, they've been going to the town committee meetings. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm giving it away any secret. I've met with both of them.
Mm-hmm.
David Stemmerman, should he be successful, is one of the smartest people I've met in politics. I mean, just brimming with ideas. Now, whether those ideas can be formed into a coherent plan for Connecticut, that's not up to me. But he is much smarter than the average person you meet as a candidate. Really interesting background and full of ideas.
We've all known smart candidates.
Up, yes, that's right. We've all known smart candidates.
A next to worthless piece of currency
yes.
at times.
And almost none of them have become governor of the state of Connecticut. So it can be a disadvantage. But I just, you know, it was refreshing to talk to someone who had a lot of interesting ideas.
But I mean, Susan, these guys look like they maybe have a different plan. I mean, typically the way that you do this, and particularly in a crowded field like this, where everybody kind of has a theoretical, Max, you should just pardon the expression, splinter of a chance.
My thumb hurts after you say
yeah,
that.
So, is you go into the convention, you try to get 15% plus a little safety margin. That allows you to get under the ballot. You qualify for the citizen election program, and you're off and running. It seems like these guys are going to maybe think about this whole thing a little bit differently. I don't know whether that works against them or not. I'm not sure anybody outside this room cares very much.
Well, I don't think that the conventions matter nearly as much as maybe we all think that they do. It could be that these guys have figured that they're just going to petition their way onto the ballot, that they'll be there in August when people are voting. They'll hold their fire until then. And really, what does the convention do except it's sort of a nice gathering for delegates and insiders. And the people who don't get 15% are probably just going to try and petition their way onto the ballot anyway. That's kind of been the pattern. If you're a high-profile candidate and you don't get the endorsement of the convention, you don't get your 15%, you can still just – you can have the signatures out there. You can collect as many as you want to, and you can get on the ballot anyway.
Although it's hard. It's hard to do that. I mean, you know
– Right, but it's not – it's harder to get 15%.
If you have millions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy if you have millions.
Right, right.
But remember, if you've qualified for public financing, you'll get $1.5 million, but not until you qualify –
For the
primary
ballot. If you get on the ballot, yeah.
So you've got if you have $250,000 that you've raised, maybe you have 100 left, you've got to use that $100,000 to collect signatures. That's when it can get really
difficult.
But
if you're filthy rich, you can just use all of your own money.
Or if you're just rich. If you have the resources to try to get on the ballot, try to get on the ballot. Because also, you know, what I think is going to happen here, and I say this because Bob Stefanowski has had kind of a remarkable early social media presence. And also, if I'm not mistaken, he's already been on the radio, I think in some places, if I'm not mistaken. What you can possibly see is people dominating the news cycle just by trying to get on the ballot. And that'll yes. continue long past the conventions in May, long past. If they have to get there, so the deadline is end of June, right?
I think that's right.
Yes.
to get on the August primary ballot.
March 1st. Sometime in March.
So you have this window to keep staying relevant, to get your name out there.
May.
You have this window to keep staying relevant, to be out there, to be in front of the cameras, to be on the radio, talking to people. That's a lot more people that you're going to than just the 200-some-odd delegates at a convention. Many more.
But it is – I mean, Susan, we know it's hard to do. Last cycle – I think it was last cycle – Chaos Muppet Joe Visconti was able to do it, but Jonathan Pelto wasn't.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, but they were for the ballot for November.
For November. That's true. That's right.
Which is easier. It's hard – it's especially hard for Republicans to get 2% because –
You got to find them.
You got to find them. They're diffuse in Connecticut. And I mean I helped a candidate in my town collect signatures for a local primary, and I was amazed at how much work it took to get 350 signatures.
Party registration is such a difficult animal in this state. During the presidential primary nearly two years ago, we were just talking to voters at polling places, and so many were being turned away saying, well, you're a registered Republican. You can't vote in the Democratic primary, or vice versa. You're a registered Democrat, can't vote in this, can't vote in the Republican one. And people were saying, oh, I thought I was registered the other way. The number of times that will happen is staggering.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is because, of course, people are normal and they're not fixated on politics.
People are worried about far more consequential things.
What's wrong with those people? Why aren't they fixated? Well, I mean, but, you know, Susan, I was sort of talking about this, I think, when Max was advancing his J.R. Romano theory when we were emailing around during the week, that, you know, for the Republicans, the other problem for the Republicans is if during the primary season you pull a Srinivasan and you go after a position that may not track very well with the general electorate, it does seem – I mean, generally here in Connecticut, the ratio is for unaffiliated to Democrat to Republican. It's about an 8-7-4 ratio. I haven't looked lately, but it's probably still tracking pretty close to that. So you're going after the 4. The 8, the unaffiliateds, may not correspond very well to what you're doing. You're probably going to the red meat element of the 4 because that's who's more likely to show up in a typical primary. In a way, for Republicans in the state, because of the registration disadvantage, they can easily box themselves into positions that they don't want to have during the general election.
Yeah, and that's a problem. And I think this is a problem that a lot of Republicans are facing all across the country, is that the real activists, the people that you really need to show up for you in a primary, especially, hold a lot of positions that do not do well in a general election, especially and right now concerning guns. This is a pretty toxic position for him to have taken. But he must feel like, again, that this is the only way that he can get anywhere.
Sorry. There really are – I mean for a lot of the listeners who may not understand, there's going to be these two paths. The conventional one, right? The conventional path of I got to raise – well, conventional the last 10 years. I got to raise my 250,000 qualifying contributions. I have to get the nomination at the convention. It looks like Mark Boughton is all in on that, the mayor of Danbury. And then you have the others.
All in, you mean that's his strategy.
That's his strategy.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to being the front runner.
Right.
Right. I think there's this distinction Kevin was going.
Right. And then you have the others who are going to try to go for the ballot. And Prasad Srinivasan is obviously going all in on the conventional strategy. But
because he has no troops.
You go south of I-84.
And I don't mean just him.
Kevin is about to jump up and down on Srinivasan's body.
A lot of these candidates, you know, you see them. They show up at events all alone. There used to be a candidate would have, I'm going to say, entourage
people.
They'd have people. Yeah, right. They'd have people, and they'd send people out to
meetings
all over the state on any given night. But these are a lot of one man bands.
And also, I really think there's this major who are people going to identify with? If you're a Stemmerman or you're a Walker or you're a Sitnik or you're a Stefanowski,
household
names. But if they're going to go around and ask for money in for a primary or for signatures, they're going to identify much better in Fairfield County than Prasad Srinivasan.
That's where the votes are.
Right. That puts them at an advantage.
So before we, I've extended this thing just because I happen to be really interested in it, and I think you guys are fascinating about it. So as long as we're staying with the campaign for the rest of this segment, Susan, what's – like I keep – every day I read a Joe Ganim story. Now, we know he can't qualify for public financing. I don't know how he gets 15% at the convention, even with Mario Testa out there on the floor, you know, trying to make whatever kind of deal can be made. Can you intuit some kind of master strategy for Joe Ganim?
Well
– I'm asking a lot.
if somehow he can get enough signatures to get on the primary ballot, I think he will. I suspect it's going to be like a 3 or 4, maybe 5-way race, and the actual primary. I don't think it's going to get whittled down all that much. And suddenly it's a free-for-all because it's first past the post. You don't need a majority. So you can win with like 25%. So that might be the strategy right there. And it's kind of a scary one because it's Joe Ganim. But maybe that's it. Maybe he actually can win because he is in the news a lot and he does have some pretty committed supporters.
Yeah. We're back to Max's theory. You know, being in the news isn't necessarily a good thing.
I know.
No, everybody thinks it's a good thing.
But, you know, everyone's taking a look at Donald Trump and saying, well, if this horrible person can win, I'm a horrible person too.
What?
Maybe I can
wisdom,
win.
Right.
Yeah.
He's doing very well at town committees. He does a good job.
Mm-hmm.
He's good on the stump. And this is only for your listeners who have pledged to Connecticut Public Broadcasting.
All right.
There is a poll out there that mm-hmm. one of the candidates has conducted mm-hmm. and was shocked to find out how well Joe Ganim is doing among Democratic primary voters.
I believe Kevin and I are thinking of the same poll. Susan Bicewicz, I believe, is polling number one according to this poll. Joe Ganim is a clear number two.
Oh, thinking of a different
poll. Oh, we are. Okay. So
we should say these are internal right. polls that are conducted
yes.
by candidates.
Right.
I want you to say what you know, but I just want to preface this by saying I always have a little bit of a prejudice against these polls because,
sure.
first of all, they're leaked to us by campaign operatives who inevitably want to tell us.
100%.
No,
that's exactly right.
Mine was leaked by enemies.
By enemies?
So, okay. Yes, so that they were
– enemies have agendas too.
Yes.
Anyway.
The poll I'm referring to had Susan Bicewicz number one, Joe Ganim clear number two, Luke Bronin, Hartford's mayor, number three, and Ned Lamont a distant fourth. And I don't – once again, you have to take part of this with a grain of salt. But it tells you the impact that Susan
– Your poll's all wrong, Max. Oh. My poll.
For crying out loud, Kevin.
My poll had Bicewicz and Lamont.
My poll's going to see your poll on the playground.
It is like the island of damaged toys, though. Yes. I mean, all these candidates have like severe liability.
But I've spoken with multiple Democrats who've said that Susan Bicewicz running for all those statewide offices has paid off because so many different Democratic town committees around the state know who she is. She showed up to every single fundraiser and event.
So many real estate agents know who she is from trying to go shopping for a district.
Oh, snap. All right. We have to take a break here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the politicization of judicial confirmations. That's going to be more exciting than I just made it sound. All right, we're back. This is The Wheelhouse. Mr. John Dankosky is not with us today, so I am hosting, God help us all, joining us here in the studio, Kevin Rennie, lawyer, Hartford Current columnist, blogs at dailyructions.com, Susan Bigelow, contributor to CT News Junkie, Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. I'm also supposed to promote what is going to be on my show at 1 o'clock today. We're going to do a show about jokes, but specifically about the fact that people inevitably wind up declaring that at a certain time, you can't joke about a particular topic. And almost every subject, every topic has fallen under that shadow from time to time. It's why Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld won't play college campuses anymore because there's just too many things they're not allowed to joke about. We're going to explore that question. Are there really things that you cannot joke about and which things are they? That'll be on the show today. All right. So speaking of tripwires, Kevin, this is something that you've been writing about on Daily Ructions. We're going to talk about two different judicial confirmations, one of them lower court, one of them the highest court in Connecticut. Let's start with Judge Emmons, though. This is Judge Jane Emmons. Or you say Emmons, but I was watching the tape of the confirmation hearing and people were saying Emmons.
Well, then
I don't know which.
I bow to their
Right.
Superior.
So what's going on here? There seem to be a group of people who don't like her. They seem to be the people who get really worked up about family court issues.
Yes.
I've never quite understood how people line up in the way that they do, other than just having had bad experiences. But what's your understanding of what's happening here?
This has been going on for decades in Connecticut. I'm sure in other places too. That the family law is the toughest area of the law. It's very emotional, and the consequences can be severe for all parties. And the litigants who are unhappy often decide to blame the judge who sat on their case or made some decisions involving their case. And in this case, right now, that judge is up for reconfirmation after her first 8 years, and she has been targeted by these people, and it is hideous. And from what I understand from talking to others, she's a very good judge.
She got confirmed.
Very smart, and they picked the wrong target.
Yeah, she got confirmed by the committee.
Yeah.
But this included billboards.
Billboards. She has, you know, anti-Semitism of, you know,
on the web. Yeah.
And these are people who are at in a constant war with the world, and
right.
She became their target.
We should say that Lee Whitnam, who is sort of running for governor and who now listens to The Wheelhouse, sorry, I'll choose my words carefully, but she was at pains because she has been an opponent of a lot of judges and feels as though the court system is very, very broken based on her own experiences in the court system, put out a press release last week saying that she did not put up that particular billboard. She said it was Frances McDormand. So, I mean, go with that, believe it or don't, I guess. But, I mean, first of all, one other thing that we should probably say is that – actually, I'm going to stay with you for just another second, Kevin. For some reason or other, if you feel that way about a judge, particularly a judge handling family court situations, the next thing you do is call Minnie Gonzalez, a state legislator from Hartford. And it's like they find her somehow, right?
Well, she's not hard to find. She's been involved with this issue for years, and
she seems very willing to participate in the
and also in the details of people's lives and going to court and really trying to insert herself into these into these really difficult cases.
Reality show producers take note. She's not going to be a state legislator forever. There'll be some opportunities here. So, Susan, I want to just transition from there a little bit to Andrew McDonald, an openly gay man, is nominated in all probability. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that. Would be expected under ordinary circumstances to be confirmed relatively easy. He's already on the Supreme Court. He's nominated to be the Chief Justice. And it seems like there's two things that are going on here. One of them is the same kind of stinky, nasty, horrible, anti-Semitic, creepy, weird people who have been attacking some of these lower court judges on the internet are now attacking him based on his sexual orientation. But there's also a more conventional kind of political challenge to him coming from at least some of the Republicans.
If he is confirmed, he will be the first openly LGBT chief justice of any state in the union. And that's a big deal. So I'm not surprised that there is some pushback, both conventional and non-conventional. This stuff that's on the internet is just gross. There was a story in The Current this morning about it. Just some of the stuff that, again, these people who are really, really angry about family court. And there's just this extremely toxic and awful website, anti-Semitic, homophobic, just awful. So, I mean, it's not surprising to see that kind of thing come out, but I feel like he's almost an incidental target, that this person, whoever this person is really targeting the entire judicial system that they're angry at and giving vent to it in the most offensive way they can think of.
Well, in some ways, though, the nominee's prayer should be, please, Lord, send me a horrible, bigoted, nasty, anti-Semitic, homophobic attacker, because it will really force a lot of people to line up on my side.
Yeah,
right?
The perfect villain.
Yeah. Well, yeah, go ahead.
There are going to be with this, to Susan's point, there's like two paths on this. There's the legitimate gripes with his legal opinions, which several well-heeled and competent Republicans have said, I disagreed with his stance on the death penalty. I disagree with his stances on other issues. And then there's the vile disgustingness that comes out there. And then those people who are coming up with actual legitimate arguments against him have to come up with a way to toe the line against, while I'm not for that stuff, but I disagree with him on these other things. But then you have leader of the Senate on the Republican side, Len Fasano, saying, I've actually kind of agree with Andrew McDonald on a number of different fronts, and I've always kind of liked him from the bench, which I think gives you a if that's not a forebearer of what it's going to look like in the Connecticut Senate, I think that gives you a real idea of where the real vitriol is coming from and maybe what the actual debate's going to look like.
So, Kevin, this yes. is – we get to an interesting philosophical point here, and I know you love interesting philosophical points. So I think this is from Neil Vigdor's story today. McDonald is getting an assist from an unlikely constituency in the confirmation process. 47 lawyers, including the law school deans of Yale, Quinnipiac, and the University of Connecticut, signed a February 15th letter to the state legislature urging it to keep politics out of the judicial confirmation process. While the letter did not mention McDonald by name, it coincides with his nomination for Chief Justice. Signers included Stanley Twardy, who was a U.S. attorney appointed by Ronald Reagan, David Ball, who's a managing partner in the Bridgeport law firm, where both Tim Herbst and House GOP leader Themis Claridis are of counsel. We write to express concern for what some perceive as a dangerous trend in confirming sitting judges for continued or elevated positions, that legislators' evaluation of sitting judges is becoming increasingly partisan in tone and increasingly focused on political concerns rather than on a judge's character, integrity, intellectual acumen, and experience. What's your take about this? Is this something you write about?
Well, my feeling is there's a reason we have eight-year terms. There's a reason that a justice of the Supreme Court has to be confirmed to become the chief justice in the Supreme Court. Andrew McDonald is a very tough operator. He was a tough operator in politics. He was a tough operator in judicial politics. He was at the center of defeating Peter Zarella for chief justice when he was a member of the Supreme Court during Jody Rell's tenure as governor.
Although not precisely analogous situation. Taco Sullivan probably did more to hurt Peter Zarella in the course of trying to help him.
They were at the heart of it.
Yeah.
They were at the heart of it with their secret meetings and documents being passed in the parking lot and that sort of. So look, this is what we do in a democracy. Mm-hmm. Hardly any judges in Connecticut are ever defeated for reconfirmation. This system is, well, part of it is rife with politics, and that's the part that gets you on the bench in the first place. So don't say, oh, politics must be banned from the judicial system.
Well, Susan, you're probably going to get the last word on this, but I mean, typically, if you were defeated, it was because you had a DUI or something like that. You know, the idea that you participated.
No, that isn't. That
well, I mean, who's ever been defeated for participating in a majority opinion of the Supreme Court?
No, that's not what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm saying there are hardly ever judges generally. Mm-hmm. On the Superior Court, mm-hmm. you know, they've been some very close calls, usually over family court matters.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Susan, you do get the last word. What's your last word on this?
So I don't see how you can keep politics out of it. It's a political process. But, you know, at least we're not like a lot of other states where judges are actually directly elected. And that, you really can't keep politics. It's actually quite overt. And that's a much more contentious process.
All right. We're going to have to sort of begin wrapping it up there. First of all, I want to thank these excellent panelists. Kevin Rennie, you read his column in the Hartford Current. Susan Bigelow, you read her column in CT News Junkie. You watch Max Reese on NBC 30. And, of course, call him if an onion ever gives you a splinter. He's there to help. He's been through it. He knows what you're going through. I want to thank everybody who helped out with today's show. I'm sure there's credits here that I should be reading. But Kion Wolf is on the board. Scott Breedy, you're going to be hearing that name an awful lot more. He's going to be producing The Wheelhouse. Katie Tularski is the big kid. She makes everything work until such time as she has her baby, in which case we'll descend into chaos. Garnet McLaughlin is a super excellent intern and kind of a name. I like Garnet McLaughlin. Sounds like that is somebody.
That sounds like a Pulitzer Prize.
Feels like she's going to be somebody. Yeah. So Katie, did I forget anybody? Well, anybody that I forgot who helped out, obviously, thank you so much. And thank you so much for listening. I'm unfortunately going to be back hosting next week, too, because John's on a protracted trip. But do tune in. We'll have another lively conversation. I promise not to screw things up.